Our learning tonight is dedicated to Lilui Nishmas Rivka Bat Yosef Shaul, David's mom, whose yard site is tonight. So the neshama should have an aliyah. Okay, and obviously for a refuah shleima and a speedy return for all those that are captured and all those that are injured, and a start of our 17th cycle together. So here we go. So the life of Sarah was 127 years, but obviously it's not written that way. It's 100 years and 20 years and 7 years. This is the life of Sarah. So it's interesting that the parasha is called Chaye Sarah, the life of Sarah, and yet really it's not the life of Sarah. It's the death of Sarah. So it seems to be a misrepresentation of what the parasha should be. So yesterday, I'll be honest, there have been a lot of funerals in Israel over the last, 5 weeks or so. And I have not gone to any of them. But yesterday, I actually went to Har Herzl for the Levaya of Rose Lubin. So she was the girl from Atlanta. She was 20 years old or so. It was pretty crazy. I mean, there were tens of thousands of people there. It was really very, very powerful. And the speakers were not easy to... The speaker system was not great. And so it was hard to hear a lot of the hespedim. So about halfway through, I started wandering around the cemetery. And when I did that, I ended up next to someone who looked the most Israeli person in the entire crowd. And he was listening to the funeral in English on his iPhone. So like a crowd of 6 or 7 American-looking people surrounding him. So there was a guy off to the side who was, I don't know, videoing himself, or someone was videoing him. And apparently he lost several members 5 years ago in a terrorist attack in the West Bank. And he said that, you know, what's amazing is that the entire funeral, the focus was not about her death, but it was about her life. And that's really like the distinction, I think, between us and our enemies, is that we celebrate life. And even in death, we talk about Chaye Sarah. These were the accomplishments of Sarah. For Sarah to have lived 127 years and did everything she did, that's a testament to her life. And we don't spend the funeral lamenting the death. And that's, I think, a stark contrast to our cousins that surround us. So that's just a slightly off topic, but I think maybe it'll swing back at the end to tie it all together. So the first question on this pasuk obviously is the question that everybody struggles with. Why is the pasuk so wordy? It could have just said "Vayu chaye Sarah me'avesu mesheva shanim," and that would have been it. We could have gotten rid of a lot of the pasuk. Why is it that it writes it that way? Okay, pasuk bet. Vatamat Sarah v'kiryat arba hi chavron be'eretz Kenan v'yavo Avraham lispo l'Sarah v'livkota. Sarah dies in Kiryat Arba, which is Chevron, in Eretz Canaan. Avram comes to eulogize Sarah and to cry for her. Vayakam Avram al pnei meito. Avram gets up from in front of his dead. Vayidaber al bnei chet lemor. And he speaks to the bnei chet, saying, Gever toshav anochi machem, tnu li achuz akever machem ekber amitim milfanayim. And he goes on to start off by saying, I'm a ger and I'm a toshav, which Rashi says is his like ultimatum to the people of bnei chet, where he says, I am a ger, but I'm also a toshav. The land is mine, but not yet. But if you don't treat me properly, I'll take it already now. But I think that the clearer way to read it is that this Pasuk Gimel and Pasuk Dalet are expressing the frustration that Avram Avinu has. He was promised so much by God, and here it is that his wife has died in the land that God has promised him. And what that he can't even find a small spot to bury her in, and that's perhaps the hardest test of all, even more so than Akedas Yitzchak, according to some, because after everything he's endured, he doesn't even have a simple place to bury his dead. Okay, so that is, you know, one, that's not a question, but that's a comment. But the two questions so far that I have is, why is the pasuk so wordy? And livkota, that's the only word in the chabur that I have to actually sit there and, like, you know, play around with the font to make sure that the chaf is actually reflective of what is in the Torah. Why is the chaf of livkota small in the Torah? So those are my two questions. Anybody else have any questions to add?
Yeah, why does it say tenu instead of like macharli?
Okay, interesting.
If he offers cash afterwards and says, "I'll pay kesef mele," why do you start off with the word tenuli?
Yeah, it's a good question. Not sure. I mean, the word achuzat kever would like imply a burial plot, which is like, which implies ownership, but I hear your question. I know. It's a good question.
And the other question is, you know, is he owned nothing? He didn't own a good burial plot or the desired burial plot? I mean, clearly he wanted this burial plot. You know, we keep saying he didn't have even, or you start saying he didn't own an inch of the land. Is that really true? I mean, the land was all settled and ownership was everywhere. He had his tents, he had his wells, he had grazing land. He wasn't stealing land from people.
Right. So it could be, I think that we did this a few years ago, that he didn't own, I mean, there certainly he didn't own like for perpetuity. But I think there were like the Nazi customs of the area of the time required certain things for real land ownership. And he didn't have that. And this was like, they were going to make an exception for it. I mean, it seems unlikely that he owned outright a piece of land for forever's sake, because that should have been written then somewhere in the Torah. You know, Yaakov buys a small field in Shechem, which really doesn't have much purpose of mentioning it in the place or subsequently, and the Torah writes all about it. So it seems hard to imagine that he didn't own, that if he owned, it wouldn't say it. But that's my guess. Any other questions? Okay, so then let's take a look at Rashi. So Rashi says, Vayuchaye Sarah. So we'll take a look at two of them. One is famous, and it's very clear. And the other one is like, we probably have seen it, we know it, but we kind of gloss over it because it's pretty short. There it says shana at each juncture, because each point in the pasuk is a different reference point. That each segment, the 100, the 20, and the 7, has its own separate drasha. So at 100, she was like 20 for sin. Ma bat chaf lo chata. Shari ain't a bat onshin, a 20-year-old is not liable up in the heavens for punishment. Af bat kuf below chayt, so to 100, at 100 she had no sins. Uf bat chav kebat zayin liyofi, and similarly at 20 she was like a 7-year-old in beauty. We did discuss this, I think, once in the past, where we said like it's somewhat inverted, right? Like when you think of beauty, you think more like a 20-year-old is generally considered more beautiful than a 7-year-old. And when we think about sin, there's a certain purity and a certain innocence that 7-year-olds have that 20-year-olds often don't have. Okay, so but Rashi is pointing out why the pasuk is so wordy. And then he says, Shnei chayei sarah kulan shevin letova, that they're all equal in good. Now, is that really true? Are they all really good years? I would argue the opposite. Think about what Sarah's life looked like. Sarah's life was a constant state of suffering. She can't have kids for a very long time. Then she's taken captivity, not once, but twice. She has to deal with Hagar. She has to deal with Yishmael. And then finally she has a kid. She gets a few years of enjoying him. And then what happens? There's the Akedah. And then she dies. Again, that's, you know, you could decide when the Akedah was and when she will die. We know she dies at 127. But either way, she does not have a good life. Like to say Kulan Shavin Latova, that all of her years were good, it seems to not be fair. So that's the third question. That's probably the biggest question of all. Yeah, David.
This 127, the famous Rashi. So, right, we've done it. Everybody knows it, is familiar with it. I just realized now, or maybe I realized before, but I've forgotten, remember now, who knows? It's not very personal to sorrow. It's like a 100-year-old is like a 20-year-old in certain respects, is like a 7-year-old. It's not very like specific to her. It's very generic. It's not like she had something happened when she was 7 or 20 or 100. Like, they're not meaningful breaks in her life. They're just like a 100-year-old is somewhat like a 20-year-old, and somewhat like he says. It just seems very impersonal to me, that Rashi's interpretation. I'm not saying it's wrong.
Right. So, I mean, the first part, I think. Yeah, I'm sorry, Shmuel.
I know, so I was just saying, like you were saying, that if the show was born at 159, then it would have been 100, it would be like 50 and 50.
Right, they would have struggled. Like, what's 50? Right. I mean, I think that to be able to say at 100 that you're sin-free or relatively sin-free is like a pretty big accomplishment. Like, I'm willing to sign up for that when my time comes. I mean, the beauty part seems to be like somewhat more vain. Although the Gemara does say that Sarah was, you know, one of the most beautiful women to ever live, and that is, you know, something special about her. Yeah, I think the sin part like has a certain personal thing. Like, I guess, I mean, if you really wanted, you could like try to benchmark at 100, there was like some other moment in her life at 20 that happened that was, you know, earth shattering. I'd like to believe that that's in Lispod Lisarah. We don't know what Avram said. How did he eulogize her? I'd like to believe that his eulogy had like that personal component in it that explained, you know, what all of her characteristics and special qualities were. Okay, any other comments, questions on Rashi? Okay, so let's take a look at Bereishis Rabbah. So it's a weird medrash. Rabbi Kiva Yayoshe Vidoresh. Rabbi Kiva was teaching. He was sitting and teaching. But Tzibor Mitnam Neim. And the congregation was falling asleep. I feel it's like a little bit like tough, because when you give your own drashos and then you sit through other people's drashos, I think it magnifies the sense of guilt when you fall asleep. So on Friday night, I feel like it's a slam dunk. The rabbi speaks for 15, 20 minutes. I'm like, I could last maybe like 2 or 3 if I'm lucky. And then I'm like completely out cold. And I know the rabbi knows that I sleep through his speech, because the shul is not that big and there's no 6'4" guy that blocks my, you know, my spot from the rabbi. So yeah, I feel bad. So it's like, it's someone pointed out on this, I did a lot of research on this specific medrash, that it's a nice thing that there is a personal component to like let us know what happened in the classroom of Rabbi Akiva. So in the classroom of Rabbi Akiva, people fell asleep. Bikesh la'oran, he wanted to wake them up. So Amar Marata Esther Shetimlach al Sheva v'esimu mea medina. So he asked, why did Esther rule over 127 provinces? El Tavo Esther Shaita Bat Bitashel Sara Shaita Mayavesim Sheva Timlocha Mayavesim Sheva Medino. So he says that let Esther, who is the great, 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 great granddaughter of Sarah, who lived to be 127, so let her rule over 127 provinces. Okay. That's how he got them up. I'm not really sure. I think nowadays we do better with serving chalent and kugel and all those other things. But yeah, I mean, this is like an age-old tactic of like of good public speaking. You pepper in some good stories, and it wakes people up. I have to say, not to like wax poetic too much, but like in the hundreds and hundreds of chaburas we've given, I actually like am proud of the fact, and not from my end, but from the tzibor that I learn with, is that we very rarely tell stories. And if we tell stories, they're usually like on point and they're just a little part and then we go on. But we like, it's qualitative learning. But yeah, if you give a drasha, like it's just a good idea to like throw a story in here and there, especially if it's Friday night or Shabbos and people are falling asleep. If you put the story in the right place, you usually like stir the crowd a little bit. Okay, so that's what Rabbi Akiva is doing. So that's nice. But the question is, why is it that of all the things to talk about, he finds this connection between 127 and 127? There are other numbers in the Torah that are similar. Yoshua and Yosef both lived to be 110. That couldn't be a drasha. And oh, by the way, Yosef and Yoshua are really from the same tribe. So like if you want a direct correlation, you can do that. Why is it this? And is there any significance to the fact that it's Rabbi Akiva that's giving this message? So those are my four questions. Again, why is this pasuk?
Same tribe.
What?
Wasn't Yeshua from Yemen? It means from the same mother?
No, Yeshua is from Ephraim.
Oh, I was thinking it was from Benjamin. I'm sorry.
No problem.
I honestly read this whole Rabbi Akiva story. I mean, I didn't see it as like he's telling a story. It seems like he was doing it to throw like some absurdity out there to wake him up. Because like, yes, well, she was 127 Medinos because that's how many Achashverosh had.
Right. Okay. But
line him up. Be like, it's because just to provoke some. What are you talking about, Rabbi?
Right. So, but then you could pick anything. Like, why? Like, meaning, what is there any significance to the? It's not like he told a funny joke, you know what I'm saying? Or an inappropriate joke. You're like, whoa, where did that come from, Rabbi Akiva? Like the fact that he, right, like the fact that he is, that he's picking these two numbers to make a correlation, like there has to be some connection. Yeah, obviously he's doing this to wake them up by like saying like, hey, wait a second, where did that come from? Like that's not consistent with like the Rabbi Akiva Eger or the Chakira and the Rambam that you were learning until now.
Do you know of any other mention of 127 in the Tanakh that, you know, he was specifically picking this one?
I have no idea. I mean, it's funny because I found this like Chabur last Shabbos at some point, maybe in Shul. So I was like, okay, the Chabur is set. But I did like, it's not as easy to find like on this specific Medrash information. There's a good video by Aleph Beta. Everybody, it's only 11 minutes long, so you can do it on your 30 minutes of free time per month if you want to watch it. But yeah, I did wonder about the number 127, but with like all the research I did not like look at that in the Concordatia. But it's a good question. Okay, so those are our four questions. So let's try to answer them a little bit. Okay, so we're going to start in, we're going to go out of order. The bottom left corner is Rav Sirotzkin. So we'll do that first. Then we'll do Rabbi Weinrib, which is to the right. And then we'll end above that with the halachos from the Rambam. Okay, so here we go. So it's like halfway down in the right in the first column. It says, so he basically says like this medrash, like what's going on? Why was she zochet to live to rule over 127 medinos? Which again, you know, to Shmuel's point, it's because Achashverosh had 127 medinot. If he had, you know, 126, then this drasha really wouldn't work so well. He says, listen, I understand. Sarah had many, 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 many great, 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 a lot of time granddaughters. Why was it Esther that was zochet to this? That it's Dafka Esther who's the granddaughter of Sarah because she inherited her qualities. That she suffered or was tested with this most terrible or most grave test, and that was to be absolutely beautiful. That she was able to withstand the test of becoming the queen as being the most beautiful woman on earth at the time, and nothing happens to her as a result. Can you imagine whatever, you know, there's constantly, you know, all the magazines have, you know, the 100 most beautiful people in the world, and then they pick the number one person. Could you imagine to be that number one person and to stay grounded? It's probably unlikely nowadays. And yet she considers herself avuda. V'amram l'mordechai kasher avadti avadti. She says, until now, every time the king sleeps with her, so she's it's rape, and therefore she's considered karka olam. But now that she's finally going to submit herself to him, beratzo, meaning she's not going to wait to be called, but she's going to come willing. She's going to come on her own. So she's lost, and yet nonetheless she stays faithful to her nation and to her God. She did not enjoy any of the luxuries of life that come with being the queen. Shirak elav he nishmat and mamar Mordechai Esther asak asher he haita b'amna ito. Okay, so basically, according to Saratskin, what they have in common is both of them, both Sarah and Esther, are tested with absolute beauty, and they're kidnapped as a result of it, and both of them remain grounded despite that. Right, Sarah, even though she was kidnapped not once but twice. And she was kidnapped both times because she was so beautiful. She doesn't let it go to her head. She remains the Sarah from beforehand. Okay, so that is Rav Saratskin in Aznaim LaTorah. Take a look to the right. We'll take a look at Rabbi Weinrib. So Rabbi Weinrib was the executive, I think, vice president of the OU for a very long time. He's a prolific speaker. She shared this at last Motzei Shabbos with someone who's my mother's age, a little bit older, and she said to me that they're very close with Rabbi Weinrib. He had a bracha at their chuppah, and once upon a time he was an amazing counselor in some camp for her. It was her husband's counselor, so it's like pretty funny. Like we think of everybody as like, you know, where they are in life, you know, when we meet them, but once upon a time. This is what Rabbi Weinrib says. He says, if one allows himself a second of slumber, he forfeits a room. If one sleeps for a week, he loses an entire city. Every segment of time represents a significant opportunity, and with every wasted moment, opportunities are lost. This is Rabbi Kiva's lesson to his sleepy students. You're not merely dozing off and enjoying idle daydreams. You should know, as I read this, I felt so guilty. I'm like, every Friday night, look what I'm doing. You are wasting time, killing time, in the process losing opportunities which will not represent themselves again. If you miss a moment of a Torah lecture, you create a void that can never again be filled. Rabbi Akiva's lesson is a lesson to all of us. In contemporary terms, it is a lesson of time management. Time is a gift, but it is an ephemeral gift. A moment lost can never be retrieved. But Rabbi Akiva insists that this is not his lesson, but Sarah's lesson. It is the legacy that she left for her descendants. Queen Esther grasped that legacy. She did not assume the role of a passive queen, but actively reigned over all of her 127 provinces. She studied their needs, recognized their individual differences, and helped each of them best utilize their unique resources. As grandmother Sarah valued each and every one of her years, so too did Esther value every one of her many provinces. So we must learn to utilize all of our blessings to the fullest, whether they be the blessings of longevity, or the blessing of political power, the blessing of wealth, or the blessing of grandchildren. Living a full life means appreciating all of our blessings and making the most of them. What wonderful teachers we have had, and how differently and creatively they taught us these lessons. Sarah taught them in the context of the family tent. Esther taught them from her royal palace. and Rabbi Akiva taught them from his classroom lectern. Okay, so even though Rabbi Akiva kind of pushes it off and says it has nothing to do with him, I think that we would all agree that Rabbi Akiva was the ultimate. He is a person that made every moment count. He's caught teaching Torah in public, and for that he goes to his death. But that's the lesson that Sarah is teaching us. She lives to be 127 years. Why? Because every year and every moment counted. Okay, so that is the second answer I want to share with you. The third and final answer is the answer by Rabbi Lamb. He gave this drasha in 1959, and in 1959 he said that people suffer more so than ever from anxiety, right? The anxiety that plagues society is just so overwhelming. I can't even imagine what Rabbi Lamb would feel if he gave that drasha from the pulpit in 2023. I added for camp this summer a form, because if you don't ask these questions, nobody tells you. Just four simple questions to get to know your child. And the first question is, does your child have any anxieties that we should know about? Oh my God. I can't even tell you how many hours of my time have been filled with calling parents to discuss these anxieties. Because I look at those anxieties, I'm like, holy cow, I don't want to spend like an overnight with this kid. So the parents have to walk me off the cliff when I hear about it. But it is so crazy. I'll highlight just one. It's great. It's actually, she is the reason why we have this forum. She came to camp last summer, and the first day of camp, we do tell the parents, we spend a lot of time outdoors. She had like a complete nervous breakdown, and she turned to Malky. She goes, I'm afraid of bugs. And Malky's like, what were you thinking, honey, when you came to this camp? What were your parents thinking when they signed you up for this camp? We're like, you should be in like coding camp in Hofstra University in an air conditioned, like, you know, computer science lab. Yeah. So anyway, could you just imagine that's the amount of anxiety that society had in the 50s is like magnified in the 2020s. So Rabbi Lamb says, how is one supposed to overcome that anxiety? So he says there's something called, I think I'm reading it right because it was transliterated from Hebrew it was transliterated in Hebrew to English letters. I think it's called hityashvut. The idea is that I try really hard to walk this middle path. No matter how good things are, no matter how bad things are, I kind of try to stay on this middle of the road path. And he quotes the Rambam, which I could not find in Sefaria. So if anybody, like, you know, goes on Sefaria, I'll do it right now, and could find where the Rambam is, I'd be thrilled. I used to have the Rambam on Dafka, and now not. So I had to, like, do the old cut and paste. So he says like this, Al yitkashe adam al meito. If someone dies, what is one supposed to do at the funeral? So one cannot be too upset. Shnemar al tivku lameit v'al tanudu lo. So one should not cry too much. When a person that mourns excessively is a fool. So he says that it's laid out. There's the first 3 days of Avelus, then there's the complete Shiva, there's Shloshim. There's a gradual process of which at each point we're supposed to lessen it. Again, it doesn't mean that that at the end of the 30 days or at the end of the year we're all healed and everything is good. But he says that one should not cry excessively. But then in Halacha Yud Bet, he says, Kol Shem Misha Eino Mitabel. But what happens if a person doesn't, like, there's no mourning at all? Kamo Shetzivu Chacham Harei Zeh Achsari. And that person is cruel. A person should look and do both. Meaning, on the one hand, there has to be a genuine sense of mourning. It just can't be too much mourning. And that is the idea that the Rambam offers. And so Rabbi Lam says that what the greatness of Sarah is, I mean, come on, let's call it how it is. Her life, Rashi's statement of Kulam Shavim L'Tova, that all of it was equal and good. It's not really that her life was equally good. It's that she maintained a balance of both faith. She kept her faith, and she, no matter how great her life became or how bad her life became, she kept everything in its proper perspective. And Rabbi Lam suggests that that's the key to life, is to not be too happy, not to be too sad. When a person is super successful, which Sarah was financially or beauty-wise, so what is a person supposed to do? A person's supposed to acknowledge that, yeah, it's a gift, it's something from God, but I don't take it and think that this is, you know, my doing. And at the same token, when there's such suffering and such bad things happen, and Sarah certainly suffers from that as well, so what happens? A person keeps it in its proper perspective as well, and says, I understand that this is just, you know, something that I have to deal with. But again, not too extreme on either side. And perhaps that's the message, the connection to Sarah and Esther and to Rabbi Akiva as well. What all three of them have in common is that their lives see this like unbelievable range of emotions, both for good and for bad. And Rabbi and Esther is able to stay grounded despite the fact that she becomes the queen. Sarah is able to stay grounded despite the fact of who she is. And from a tragedy side, look at what each of them sees. Esther loses her ability to be free, and yet she's able to keep that in its proper perspective, and she doesn't mourn in excess the loss of her own personal life and all that. And Rabbi Akiva is probably the best example of this. He is able to see, and he is the Gemara at the end of Makos, I think, is the perfect example of it. He's able to see the tragedy of the Beis HaMikdash, and he's able to see the aftermath of it, not just the destruction, but the destruction and what that looked like. The fact that just a few years later, it was such a desolate place, and it was a place that the foxes were hanging out. And yet, he did not allow it, like his fellow colleagues did, to drag him into a place of complete Yeyush, but rather, what does he do? He's able to see and keep perspective. And I'll just end with this. I heard an interesting idea. Never thought I would quote Rav Nachman of Breslov, but I quoted Rav. I heard Rav, a nice idea by Rav Nachman of Breslov from Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, that he says that when we talk, there ain't Yeyush. There's no such thing as Yeyush in the world. And when there's Yeyush, it's Yeyush Shalom Idat. It's that we stop thinking properly, and that's when we have Yeyush. Rabbi Akiva's message to his students is, and maybe that's why the message comes from a place of the classroom. A classroom is a place that's supposed to be what? Hopefully. And, you know, Steve is part of Turo University, which is a place that seems to have its like head on straight nowadays, which I think in the academic world is like not something to be taken for granted. But, you know, what? It's a place that we're supposed to learn and be like, conscious. You can't have Yeyosh in the classroom if you're really thinking. Rabbi Akiva says, wake up. You have to have Das. You have to actually think properly. If you have your head on straight, then even though things are terrible, you'll be able to keep on the proper path, and hopefully good times will follow. I just like to end off by saying I'm, you know, really, really deeply touched that everyone continues to still learn together with me. And I look forward to Mirat Hashem to another wonderful year together, and God willing, many, many more years to come. Have a wonderful Shabbos.